This is Aspen Ideas Health on Aspen Public Radio, a five-part series partnering with the Aspen Ideas Health Conference. All week, we hear conversations with an exceptional mix of inspiring and provocative experts who dive into topics of global and domestic health.
There's no optimal version of immune system genes.
You are doing something. You are not doing something intelligent.
I think governments should be the primary providers of healthcare. And I don't think they are doing enough.
It opened my eyes to the possibility of everything that's going on with our human bodies and how little I knew, and quite honestly, how little any of us know.
I'm Allison Bektesh. Today we look at the frontiers of health and medicine and ask, what is health? What is medicine? How do we define these terms in the U.S. and around the world? What are we getting right? And what still needs work? Coming up, we turn to Aspen Ideas Health speakers for the answers. Thanks for tuning in to Aspen Ideas Health on Aspen Public Radio. Stay tuned. There are 7.7 billion people on Earth. They each have their own stories, their own struggles, and their own bodies whose genetic makeup, immune system, and health parameters are unique to them. Add to it the vastly different conditions in which they are born, grow up, age, and the range of societal understandings of what being healthy means and who even has access to health. Each of these billions and billions of people embody an entire health narrative. We're going to start with just one of them.
My name is Edna Masi. Oh, let me start again.
Edna Masiwa lives in Zimbabwe. She's the executive director of the Women's Action Group, a nonprofit focused on ending violence against women and girls and educating communities about reproductive and sexual health. She grew up in a large family that was hit hard by the AIDS epidemic of the 80s and 90s.
Growing up, I was born in a family of six, and I was the third child, if you can call it the third child, because the first two were twins. We grew up together with my siblings. Most of the time we were together in the rural areas. As we speak now, I've lost three of my sisters. The twins are now late because of they died from AIDS.
By default, she served as a caretaker to her siblings. She watched as her third sister elected to stop taking antiretroviral medication, ARVs, due to misinformation and cultural beliefs.
And she was on ARVs, I think, for about 4 or 5 years. But with time, I think she got fatigued, you know, from taking the tablets. And what we also notice in Zimbabwe, there is this strong religious beliefs that if someone prays for you, that you will be cured of AIDS. And she belonged to one apostolic sect where she also received the same information, and she defaulted. Unfortunately, she even did not say that she had defaulted, but we later learned when we took her to the clinic that she had defaulted.
Now Masiwa devotes her life's work to educating patients and caregivers, often women, in rural areas, a fulfillment of a childhood dream.
When I grew up, you know, when you're a young girl, you always say, when I grow up, I want to be a nurse. And that's exactly what I kept on saying. I wanted to be a nurse when I grew up.
She began her medical career in a maternity ward, but turned to activism after a fateful visit from the Minister of Health.
At the hospital where I was working, we would have floor beds where women who have just delivered would be put. They would sleep on the floor because all the beds were taken. All the women who were on floor beds were quickly put to sit on benches, so that the minister would find them seated like they are waiting a discharge. So I think that's really angered me, because for me, this was an advocacy point where I thought the minister should see those women on the floor. For me, I thought those were really injustices, where you could then give a false picture that women are okay. But it was apparent that this hospital did not have enough beds. So with this false information, that also meant that the ministry would not plan accordingly to the needs that were on the ground. I think governments should be the primary providers of health care, so that all the public health system should be catering for those in need of health care. And I don't think they are doing enough.
The government, I think, of the United States certainly right now is not one that is thinking that way. But I believe that there are many people at many levels of government and in many states and many governments across the world who are thinking that way, and that's the view that will prevail.
Don LeGans, former executive vice president and chief brand officer at Planned Parenthood, is now the expert in residence at IDEO, a global design company with programs focused on the future of health access and technology.
When we look at this country all the way back to the very beginning, there have been pretty big gaps in what the people at the wealthiest end of the spectrum and those at the least wealthy end have access to. I do think that, you know, technology does what it does in most things, which is that it exacerbates some of those gaps and it closes some of those gaps.
As access to technology rises, for instance, access to healthcare can as well. Telehealth, communicating with medical professionals via video calls, for instance, can give rural patients access to specialist or primary caregivers that they otherwise wouldn't be able to see. But there are larger systems operating behind the technology, says Ali Raja, an emergency room doctor and the executive vice chairman in the Department of Emergency Medicine for Massachusetts General Hospital, as well as an associate professor at Harvard Medical School. And those systems need work.
The problem with telehealth right now is that it requires a state medical license. And so, for example, if you're a physician here in Massachusetts and your patient travels to Connecticut or to California, you can't treat them when they're in Connecticut or California. And so telemedicine is really limited now by states for some reason. And if you think about it, it really doesn't make sense. If we made a federal medical license and allowed physicians who are licensed in one state to be able to practice all over the country, it would make access to the physicians who know us the best much easier.
Like many, Raja's first experience in a hospital was at birth.
I was born in the Himalayas, actually, in a really tiny town just outside of another small town called Abbottabad in Pakistan. And I was born in a small two-room hospital that I've been back to look for since, and it just doesn't exist. It's one of those small clinics that was open in the middle of the mountains, and my parents were able to go there to get me delivered. But after that, a few years later, according to family, it just got out of business and torn down, so I can't even go to the hospital in which I was born.
He moved to the States as a child, in Houston, Texas, where his exposure to the health industry consisted mostly of checkups at the doctor's office.
I wasn't really exposed to much medicine there. I had a primary care doctor, I had a pediatrician, but, you know, we weren't the kind of neighborhood where there were a lot of dermatologists prescribing Accutane, because the folks there just didn't have that kind of income. So we didn't have a lot of exposure to more specialized medicine. What we did have, though, was primary care, and we were all relatively healthy because of that.
He trained to be a paramedic in college, which was eye-opening because for many of the calls he would go to around the Rice University campus, there was nothing he could do to help.
It forced me to understand my limited knowledge, and it made me want to go and learn more. And whether that was becoming a paramedic, whether that was becoming a nurse, in my case it was becoming a doctor, but it basically opened my eyes to the possibility of everything that's going on with our human bodies and how little I knew, and quite honestly, how little I know now, how little any of us know now.
You are listening to Aspen Ideas Health on Aspen Public Radio. In this five-part series, we hear from speakers who will be presenting at the Aspen Ideas Health Conference, produced by the Aspen Institute, June 20th through June 23rd. Today, we explore our current healthcare system and the conference track, Frontiers of Health and Medicine. Emergency room doctor Ollie Raja says the U.S. is really, really good at responding in a crisis.
Especially in big cities, but even in more rural places, if you hit the 911 buttons on your phone, you'll be able to get an ambulance to come pick you up. You'll have well-trained and exceptionally well-equipped paramedics picking you up and taking you to the hospital. In the rest of the world, that just isn't true.
Inside the hospital, though, it's not the magic pills and miracle surgeries depicted on television.
They come in and you work on them and you just can't get them back.
But even when all goes right, extended care is lacking, which leaves people in hospitals longer, taking up beds, because they have nowhere else to go.
Usually the medical care is not the reason why patients end up staying in the hospital longer than planned. It's about the coordination of outpatient care that ends up holding things up.
Across the board, families are isolated, extended families are not in place. Supports that we would have normally had as part of our health care, and our life course, those things aren't there anymore. And now to bring them back, it's considered going backwards.
Jenny Joseph is the CEO of Common Sense Childbirth, Inc. She's a midwife, a career that is oddly labeled alternative, even though, as she says, women helping other women give birth has been in existence since the beginning of the human race.
Yes, women have helped each other and delivered each other's babies since time.
The holistic view of health is coming into fashion. Well, coming back into fashion.
Well, you know, if you think about it, we've had some little forays over the years, well, at least since I've been here, into what we call patient-centered care. And, you know, there's the like, oh, this is a new and amazing thing, and let's all study it and see if we can implement it. And let's have conversations and conferences and see if this could possibly be so, as if that isn't an integral part of medicine, period.
Don Warren is an Oglala Lakota and Associate Dean for Diversity, Equity, and Inclusion at the School of Medicine and Health Sciences at the University of North Dakota. He points out the data we're seeing now about using mindfulness and gratitude to help your health, or the practices of learning more about a whole patient's life, not just their metrics, is one American Indians have always done.
I think one of our challenges in modern medicine is that we focus primarily on physical health. Another word for a doctor is physician. So we're kind of saying right up front that we deal in the physical arena. Whereas in traditional medicine, at least the way I was taught from a Lakota perspective, is that to be healthy is to be in balance among physical, mental, spiritual, and emotional forces. So in truth, incorporating modern medicine to address physical ailments in a much broader, holistic, and comprehensive traditional approach that's culturally relevant, from my perspective, is very powerful.
Many of the Aspen Ideas Health speakers mull the question, who deserves health, and who is responsible for providing it? Warren and others have personal experience with the government stepping in. When he was young, a government nutrition program was brought to his community. They delivered food in the form of lard, powdered eggs, powdered milk, sugar, flour, Spam, and the only type of cheese I've ever heard of that doesn't sound appealing.
Of course, commodity cheese, government cheese. They also used to distribute pure corn syrup, which is essentially a toxin. And on the label from the USDA Commodity Food Program, the label for the corn syrup, it says, use in your baby formula. and it says use on your pancakes. So in truth, there's a lot of policy-based inequity, even when it comes to access to healthy foods. And quite often, the food programs are not nutritional programs, they're financial programs, they're economic programs for the producers of food to sell their cheap and unhealthy items to populations that can't afford healthier choices. So we make conscious decisions every day in policymaking that marginalize some populations and benefit others.
And it's not just in the U.S. In Kenya, physician and health economist Walter Ochen watched as government programs missed the mark of basic health care time and time again. Each year during flooding season, the government would deliver anti-malarial drugs. But for his community of 40,000, Ochen was given 1.2 million doses, 30 times what he needed. And communities that just need access to water were getting grants for high-tech oncology equipment.
The thing is, like, from where I come from, we are firm believers that health is a human right, and it's a basic human right. And once you have that legal argument, then really government has to play a role in ensuring that people get the help that they need. But looking at where I come from, I think the challenge at times is just to offer the basics before we even move to the big things. Looking at Kenya, there are parts of Kenya where only 12-15% of people have access to clean water. 2 years ago, the Kenyan government went ahead and leased fancy equipment from, I think, General Electric, placed them all over the country. One in places where people don't have water, they don't have doctors, they don't have nurses. People are dying from diarrheal diseases, and you bring oncology equipment. So in as much as you feel you are doing something, you are not doing something intelligent.
So again, let's ask, what is our healthcare system? Is it just another industry like fashion or automotive, where companies make products that they sell to customers for profit? The Center for Disease Control calls healthcare the fastest growing sector of the U.S. economy. Over 18 million people work in the industry. The Centers for Medicare and Medicaid calculate that the healthcare industry in the United States is a $3.5 trillion industry. That's pretty lucrative for a service that should theoretically make itself unnecessary if it worked properly. If we cured all diseases and kept all people healthy, where would all those jobs and dollars spent go? So do we really want to improve our population's health outcomes? Nasha Fitter is a mom. She's a mother to a child with a rare severe neurological condition called FOXG1 syndrome, which makes her a de facto expert in the healthcare system and the research that goes behind it.
You know, right now, a biopharma company will invest once they know certain parameters are met, right? They want to de-risk their investment. But just to get to that place requires so much investment, and to just leave that up to philanthropy makes it for most parents really impossible. Even within our community, it's only like five of us that have the ability to even go and fundraise and do all this work. You know, the rest of our parents are just trying to make it through a day-to-day basis. I mean, there's something broken in that system, and then there's something extremely broken in the system that, for the most part, I don't think most pharmaceutical companies want to cure diseases. Like, their whole model is built on medicine, right? And medicine not to cure, but medicine to help. So the idea that you have a drug therapy, a gene therapy that could completely cure a child, I don't even know if our healthcare system is like ready for something like that.
Even as the industry grows to astronomical levels of health and wealth, those billions of bodies living on Earth are one step ahead. Dan Davis is professor of immunology at the University of Manchester. He calls our own defense system the most miraculous weapon in our quest for health.
That is one of the most wondrous things about the immune system, that your body has to be able to fight off things that are alien to itself. But not only that, things that are alien in the universe. Your body has to have the ability to fight off different kinds of germs, for example, a flu virus that has never before even existed. So that is quite an astounding task for a system to have.
The way our body survives every day is more signature than a thumbprint.
The immune system is the most individual part of you. But I have to say that what's really important in that is that there's no optimal version of immune system genes. So it's not like there's a perfect immune system. Each of us have an enormous diversity in our responses to different diseases. And for me, this is one of the most wonderful things about the immune system, that we see deep fundamental reasons for why human diversity is so important. Because of the way we've evolved to fight off these different diseases, we have to, as a species, have huge, enormous diversity in our immune system genes.
From the newest technology to our original white blood cell defense system, to the question of who deserves healthcare and who should be providing it, and what factors truly make up a human being, the speakers of the Aspen Ideas Health Conference are taking on these questions firsthand. I also ask each of them one more question. I wanted to know what these experts, who every day wake up and work on issues of health justice or education or policy or emergency room care, what they do to stay healthy themselves. Not one of them mentioned going to the doctor.
Well, that's an unfortunate question, because I have to say I don't really do that much to stay healthy. In fact, I do quite a lot to stay unhealthy.
But you do keep yourself stressed out, and you eat junk food, and you live your life in a happy way. And
I'm sure I eat enough junk food and drink wine and eat cake and slouch about reading books. So I don't know. Yeah, unfortunately, I haven't really mastered that part of my life.
It's sort of unique, and my wife and I make fun of each other all the time for it, but it's fun. And so a few years ago, we started doing something called Krav Maga, which is it's an Israeli martial art. But the key to it is that we do it together. And so what we have is we have on Monday and Wednesday nights, we have a date night set up where we work out for an hour. We stay super sweaty. There's a local Asian restaurant that is willing to feed us, even though we come in looking like we just left the gym. They know what we want. So we get this great workout date night. But then in order to stay healthy and connected, we also walk in and just talk to each other for an hour, hour and a half at dinner. We prepay the babysitter so that if we try to bail on this date night, we're also losing the, you know, $75 that we're paying the babysitter. So it's about the physical health of going to work out, but it's also just about making sure that in our busy lives with our two little boys that are just crazy busy and full of stuff, that there is at least two nights a week that we just get to reconnect with each other. And it's that, the working out is really nice, but it's the hour of just connecting over dinner without having to think about all sorts of other stuff other than each other that I think really keeps me healthy.
A number of things. One is I enjoy a good laugh. Two, I go for the occasional long walk and jog, and just talk to people, hang out. If you look at me, I think I'd say like I'm a very average person in terms of my habits. Even I buy my clothes ready-made, so to speak. So, yeah. So like, yeah, I go for like at least a jog every second day and hang out and just try to be happy.
For me, as a parent with young children and a full-time job, it's partially about finding space for myself is really important for me in terms of my mental health. And very often for me, that's exercise. But then also, I think that the power of meditation and mindfulness is really incredible. And that's something that I rely on, and I work to find space for on a daily basis for my own mental health. And it's something that it took me a long time to really fully embrace, but I think that it's very important. And I think that we live in a context now where our attention is just being constantly pulled in many different directions, and finding the space to slow down is really huge. And for me, that's what gives me the ability to focus when I need to focus.
You know, for me, I'm very fortunate. I've got a wonderful wife and family. I have four kids, and we have a very happy and healthy home. And the truth is, I probably do work too much, and I travel a lot, and I try to stay as balanced as possible. And I certainly don't want to take too much time away from my own family and my kids deserve my time too. So I don't have any hobbies. You know, I work and I'm with my family, which is fine. I'm very happy with that. I think on the professional side, my challenge is that it feels like there's a million days of work to do. It's almost frantic, almost frenetic, because there's so much work to do. But in truth, if I'm lucky, I've got maybe 6,000 days of work left in me. So how am I going to fit a million days of work into that?
Myself, I do a lot of walking early morning before I come to work. I walk. During the walks, normally I have a friend whom I work with. So sometimes we just talk and share on issues affecting us. But sometimes I walk alone. You know, when you walk alone, you get time to reflect and think through your life, think through what you are doing, even at work. And I try to keep positive energy even in my work. I know sometimes I come across disturbing stories in the course of my work, but I try and do a lot of debriefing. I also eat healthy. Spiritually, I also turn to God in times of sorrow. In terms of whenever I face challenges, I turn to God. And I think I am staying healthy because of my children. All my children, you know, my nieces and so forth, we have a lot of quality time together. A lot of get-together moments, birthday parties and so forth. Then it really rejuvenates me and makes me want to keep going, keep on going.
Join us all week as we dig into the ethics and values of our healthcare system, learn more about patient-centered care, take a frank look at mental health, and come to terms with aging. I'm Allison Bektesh. You've been listening to Aspen Ideas Health on Aspen Public Radio, in partnership with the Aspen Ideas Health Conference, produced by the Aspen Institute, running in Aspen June 20th through June 23rd.